morning, everyone. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, our guests are in town for the Virginia Festival of the Book, and we are lucky enough to have snagged them for an hour this morning. We have novelist and short story writer Karen E. Bender. She is a visiting distinguished professor of creative writing at Hollins University in Roanoke, Virginia. Her latest book of short stories, The New Order, has been long listed for the Story Prize. Among many other accomplishments, Karen is the fiction editor for Scoundrel Time. Also on the show is Susan DeVan Harness. She's a writer, speaker, and oral historian and member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. Her new book, Bitterroot, a memoir of transracial adoption, is a sweeping examination of her life that explores the uneasy intersection of race, history, and the brutal government American Indian policies that affect the lives of her and her families. My friend Nancy Lawrence, speaking of family, are you there?
Speaking of March Madness, I'm totally here. I know we have a double show today. It's going to be amazing. We have our own Final Four.
We have. So what Nancy's talking about is at noon today, from noon to one, we're going to have another special show with another author that's going to be here, Leona Sevick. And Alex Zaretta.
Yeah, I know. It's everything in the era. We're now in the era of former special counsel
Robert
Swan Mueller.
Although he has stayed on, which is interesting. What do you think that means?
It's true. That's true. Or so they say.
Right, so they say.
Mr. Barr writes.
Yes.
He intends, you know. But yeah, I know. I think it was like 675 days, I heard, of
his investigation.
Of documents. I imagine him yesterday sitting in, Mr. Mueller, I imagine him sitting in front of his computer with like a Word doc open and just the words on the top, the Mueller report with like a cursor blinking, you know, like a term paper.
just like, I got a cram.
Webster's defines investigation as, anyway.
Well, experts are calling it just the end of the beginning of the investigation. And that it's just the portion that he retained for himself, but that he's passed the baton on, so to speak, to the Southern District of New York, for example, and also perhaps the Eastern District of Virginia.
We both got some offices.
You and me.
Both still under advisement by Mr. Mueller. It's true. Yeah,
there's much too much stuff happening in Virginia for my taste. But and Speaker Pelosi is meeting with the Democrats on a conference call today at 3:00. So I'm glad there's something happening. I don't know what it might be. But, you know, Trump, he sits right in the middle of a crime syndicate. So how nothing could happen, which is what I was thinking last night. But I think there's much more to it, as we'll see.
Right. They're all forgetting that we actually don't know anything yet.
Yeah, right.
Like everyone run with the, I got it. So I can't. I anticipate he will, of course, exonerate himself, forgetting 675 days of no collusion will now be, I told you, even though he never believed it in the first place. It'll be one of those gaslighting affairs for sure. One of many.
Yeah. Well, do you think it's coincidental that yesterday, I don't know if you heard this, yesterday, this day in history is the day that Nixon was, I guess the tape was released that he was talking about the cover-up that really buried him.
I did hear that. And I was thinking, you know, similarly, if Trump had said, Russia, if you're listening into, you know, amongst his syndicate in the Oval Office, and that had come out as a tape, how different, you know, because he does everything in the open.
I continued to discount it. Which,
but
again,
I did hear that, Ellen. Yeah.
Yeah, and if nothing happens with everything out in the open, is what I was thinking. Then we are. I mean, you know, we're just doomed. But let's talk about happy things. Happy writer sitting here, and the 77 shows that we have on Apple Podcasts, and the contest. We have a contest. We're giving away Randy Rainbow tickets for the May 2nd concert at 8 p.m. at the Paramount. So look on social media. We're going to be posting some questions. I think, Nancy, you already did, and we'll be giving away 3 tickets.
Nice pivot, Ellen.
Pivot.
Yes. To the guests. So, very good. I'm with you.
Our first guest, very happy to have her here, is Karen E. Bender. She, as I mentioned, is here for the Virginia Festival of the Book. She's a novelist, a short story writer, visiting distinguished professor of creative writing at Hollins University. Her latest book of short stories is The New Order. It's been longlisted for the Story Prize. Her short story collection, Refund, was a 2015 National Book Award finalist, and she's won two Pushcart Prizes. Her short fiction has appeared in many, many magazines, including The New Yorker, Plowshares, Story, The Yale Review, many, many more, too many to mention. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be here.
Great. So, congratulations on your collection of short stories, The New Order. The reviews are just dazzling. It's been called a powerhouse of a book, and that each story is brilliantly crafted. So I know it's an exploration of American culture over the last couple of years. So what made you decide to take on that topic, things like toxic masculinity, xenophobia, economic instability?
Great question. Well, after Refund, which was an examination of kind of economic instability in the United States in the two recessions for 2002, 2008, and the emotional cost of that, especially in the middle class in America. I was writing a few more stories kind of relating to that. The story Three Interviews relates to that. And then it was like 2014, 2015, and Trump was starting his campaign. And I sort of saw what was happening. And what I do with my fiction is I deal with some unrest within myself. It's either either something internally or something in the world that I want to deal with. And after Trump was elected, I felt this grief for the country that I'd never felt in quite the same way. I had felt grief for a person, but not for a country. And I thought something had died. It seemed some hope for, you know, a female president, you know, just hope for you know, any progress that was made under President Obama. And I just felt I had to start addressing it in my fiction. It was a way of coping, really.
So how did these stories, the ones that you put in this book, The New Order, wind up? How did you select those in particular?
I mean, I think my process of writing is actually a little chaotic. I just kind of respond to things that are going on, you know, something that feels emotionally interesting to me. For example, the story The Elevator, which is about the effects of a sexual assault and kind of how it reverberates over time in the context of a woman in an elevator, was a response to the Access Hollywood tapes. And I just thought, well, you know, this is something in the air and there are all the Me Too stories. I thought I really want to address this through fiction and look at, you know, in a way, I think fiction changes us from the inside. It's different than, say, a Facebook post or a tweet, you know, or an editorial even, that you feel what a character is going through. So I was responding to different things going on around in the news.
So can you talk about some of the stories that really look really, really interesting?
Yeah.
You know, I like This Is Who You Are, for instance, but is there one that you would like to, I mean, I would like you to talk about that one, about a young girl who is, you know, walking to Hebrew school and,
right,
you know, talking about that in regular school.
Right. I mean, that was a story about, it's set actually in the 1970s about a lot of the stories are actually relating to being Jewish, which has been, it feels different now being Jewish, in the last 2 years, 3 years, than it had kind of growing up for me. It's a story of a girl in Hebrew school and, they're in Los Angeles in the 1970s, which felt like a very kind of safe place to be Jewish. And what happens is there's an attack in Israel at a school. It's called Maalot, and all these kids are killed. And so after that, the kids are sent home from Hebrew school because there's actually a threat made at another temple. And she's kind of surprised about this. And so she goes to her regular junior high school, and it's, she's there, the students are dealing with a different threat, which is a coach who's basically a pedophile and making moves on one of her friends. And so it's really about different sorts of threats in the world, kind of externally and also, you know, on a very local level.
And similarly, in the theme of Jewish, you had written the first The first story, yeah, you already know. So go ahead. Where to hide it in synagogue?
That's a really, it's really powerful, actually, to me, to be in Charlottesville and talking about that story, because I wrote that story in reaction to the Nazi rally, you know, that was here, you know, the white supremacist rally. And what this story actually started a few years ago when I was driving my daughter's carpool, and it was after the Aurora shooting, and she and a friend were talking where they would hide in a movie theater if someone came in and started shooting. And I just, you know, should they run? Should they duck? And I just listened to this and I was horrified. But I also thought I need to write about this because that's sort of how I deal with chaos. So I started a story, Where to Hide in a Movie Theater. It was kind of a list. It was like a flash fiction piece. And then after the rally, I read about what was happening with the synagogue here. I was curious, like, you know, when they're shouting with torches, Jews will not replace us. What was happening at the synagogue? And I was reading that, you know, there were all these, armed guys, saying Sig Heil, and that the synagogue members had to leave out the back door to avoid violence. And so that kind of freaked me out. And so I thought I do need to set this in a synagogue. And so I started, thinking about two friends, and they're tasked with presenting a report to the temple board on how to keep the congregants safe in case there's an attack. And so it was actually a way to explore the friendship between these women and also how they're kind of going through the synagogue trying to control the uncontrollable.
And the title of the collection, The New Order, why did you choose that as a title?
Good question. Well, the story The New Order is also about relationship of two friends and violence, actually also a shooting in the 1970s that happens to a friend of theirs. And the New Order, they're in an orchestra and they're in the cello section. And one of the students that's killed is a cellist. And so they need to audition to create a new order for the students. And so I just thought that was very haunting. It was a haunting image. And then the New Order did feel like it had a metaphorical resonance too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, Karen, I'm circling back to Where to Hide in a Synagogue, because I read that, unbeknownst to you, that the book, you know, that story about Where to Hide in a Synagogue came out 10 days after the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh, the shooting there. And I was just wondering if you've ever written anything that is coincidentally timed with something in the real world. And even if you hadn't, it certainly did that time. So what was that like to experience?
Right.
That?
No, it's a great question. The story was written a book takes, 8 months to come out. So it was written several months before. It was right. The Tree of Life shooting was 10 days before the pub date of the book. It was shocking. It was horrifying. And it also wasn't surprising to me because, people would say, oh, the story was so prescient. I don't have ESP. I can't see what's going to happen in the world before it happens. But basically, a writer's job is to keep your eyes open and to be alert. And I feel it's all our jobs, really. You know, how do we, and basically, when, you know, through Trump's rhetoric, through this, you know, what happened here, you know, in Charlottesville, you could see the signs, you know, that of targeting of not only Jews, but of, you know, Muslims, as we have saw, you know, as we've seen this last week, you know, people of color, women. So many groups have been targeted by Trump. I just actually saw an article in the Washington Post that said hate crimes have gone up 226% in counties that hosted a Trump rally. You know, so the line is actually not that hard to see.
So are you accustomed now, since, you know, you've got Refund, which has some similar themes, and definitely this book. Are you accustomed to people, you know, or reviews, you know, calling your work politically timely? Is that on your mind?
I think that's, I mean, I'm happy about that. I mean, I do feel that I like, you know, part of the part of it, my job as a writer is to engage what's going on in the world. I don't feel like all my work necessarily does, you know, as directly, but I feel like, you know, we're in this, you know, this certain time, and it's, you know, some of my favorite writers have, you know, capture, you know, that, you know, the time they're in a way that's really, that's powerful.
And as you go around, you know, whether a book festival or a book signing, et cetera, are certain stories from the New Order getting more questions than others? How's that going?
Good question. I think people do ask about Where to Hide in a Synagogue. People ask about the Department of Happiness and Reimbursement, which was one of my favorite stories to write. It's the one dystopian story in the collection, and the cell phone story. I think people tend to, they focus on certain ones.
So just turning a little bit to your process, I noticed on your website you have the Ten Commandments for becoming a writer.
Uh-huh.
Which also is part of your theme of Judaism. do you remember, you know, what the first one is?
The first one is right.
Yes. You are right. You are correct.
That, you know, it's interesting. I wrote those when I was trying to become a writer, you know, when I was in my 20s, and I had no idea what to do. It was just so confusing. I feel there's a lot of mythology about becoming a writer. You're going to be hit by lightning, and you're genius. And I feel like that's actually very destructive, and it's a lot of just about work and revision and just doing it and just believing despite everything. And so I kind of wrote those to kind of calm myself down or try and give myself a path. And it's how I start all of my classes as I read them. And I go over what was important, what was helpful to me in them.
That's so great. I like number four, pretend you're a great writer.
I think that's incredibly important in terms of being a writer because it's all invented. And there, I think our culture is kind of conspires to make writers feel small and also, you know, are very focused on, are you published? But actually, you're a writer when you're writing. You're a writer when you're doing it and you're really committing to it. And I think that's important for especially beginning writers to know that a lot of it is pretending. And actually, my name, Karen Ebender, you know, that's my writer name. It was something, you know, I had really bad cursive when I was in elementary school. And I had my E's were just like really unreadable, and my friends would kind of tease me and say Karen Ebender, and I started writing then, and I would always put the E and I'd say this is my writer name, and it felt like it wasn't necessarily me, it was this other person, and that felt freeing as a writer.
That's very interesting that it goes so far back. I had no idea. I assumed, of course, it was all like a social media thing. Like you had to because there was a Karen Bender.
Right, I did too.
No. It's from when I was in elementary school.
That's amazing. Where do you look then for inspiration? Is that a commandment? Where to look for inspiration?
I think for me, there are just so many stories to tell. There's so many things to respond to in the world. You know, I think just you open a newspaper and there's something you want to address, or you have an experience that's frustrating and you want to, you know, take revenge or, you know, redo something that happened that you wish had been different. They're just all different ways of finding inspiration.
So we're speaking with Karen Bender and you're listening to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC. Karen Ebender is what I meant to say. We're going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we will be speaking a little bit more with Karen Ebender and then also Susan Devan Harness, writer, speaker, oral historian. Stick with us, everyone. Don't go away. Welcome back, everyone. This is WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're on 94.7. My guest today with Nancy Lawrence, my co-host, is Karen Ebender. We're going to speak a little bit later to Susan Devan Harness. So Karen has made a lot of lists. She's on the 21 must-read books set in a post-Trump world, one of 23 hot picks for cool fall books from the Boston Globe. I just wanted to mention that. And I know Nancy's standing by with a question.
I was, actually. It's funny you say that, Ellen.
I can read your mind.
I was wondering just one, maybe there'll be more, but at least this question about the New Order, the last story, is called Cell Phones, as you mentioned. And, you know, you take us through, like, school shootings and sexual misconduct and religious intolerance. And that one had, well, as you know, since you wrote it, you know.
Wait, Nancy, I hear sirens.
Huh?
I hear sirens in New York City right now.
Oh, yes.
Well, sorry.
Speaking of school shootings and economic stability and religious intolerance, who knows? But that idea of staying engaged with people, you chose that as your last story. Why did you choose that as your last story?
Yeah, so the last story is called The Cell Phones, and it's about this woman whose cell phone goes off in the middle of High Holy Day services in her synagogue, which is, you know, one of the holiest kind of time in Judaism in the year, and to have your cell phone go off is horrible. And actually, mine did at one point in a service, and it was mortifying. And of course, then I was like, well, I've got to put this in a story. But in the story, a woman's cell phone starts going off, and then everyone else's cell phone starts going off in the sanctuary. And what happens is people are calling with complaints, and it's just basically all the grievances of the world, you know. And what happens is that people will keep calling until the other person actually listens to them and says, instead of saying stop, says I know, or you know, that's hard, or listens and actually gives himself a chance to process someone else's pain. And I actually do feel this country's in a huge amount of pain, and listening is helpful. And I feel like there is hope. I mean, I just feel like there's hope since the midterm elections, you know, that people turned out enough and they were, you know, motivated enough to make change in the House of Representatives, and that people can be active if they remain engaged. So I do feel hopeful. In one sort of nice little development, I just heard from a woman who's a pastor at a Unitarian church in Canada, and she had read this story to her congregation recently, and actually had planted people in the congregation whose cell phones would go off at certain times, and so it was almost like a meta experience, and I just love that.
Yeah. That is, yeah. I was going to ask you what you've heard from people, because listening to you, it seems like your stories are very inspirational and helpful, actually, as you say, during this time.
Good.
Yeah. So have you heard stories, if you could not be humble and just share some of those with us?
I mean, people have been, I mean, it's interesting because you never know how a book will be received. But, you know, when I, you know, hear from people or read reviews, you know, the people have been very positive, and they like seeing, their feelings mirrored. I mean, I feel like fiction has three roles. It's, you know, as a witness, you know, kind of what's going on, as a warning, you know, how to maybe prevent things, and also as a mirror, you know, that you can see your experience in some way mirrored, you know, and it doesn't have to be that someone has my, you know, direct experience, that you feel something emotionally relatable. And that's just the joy for me of fiction, is when people relate.
And you're also a fiction editor, not only a writer. You're responsible for this online magazine called Scoundrel Times. So what's in Scoundrel Times?
Yeah, so Scoundrel Times is an online magazine that Paula Wyman is the editor in chief. And right after election, you know, a lot of us were really in despair, and she organized an online magazine that would be creative responses to the current political era, whether it's fiction, creative nonfiction, or poetry. And so it's different from, say, an editorial. It's emotional and it's creative. And we have also photography and art sometimes and music. And it's been really a comfort to work on, because then you can present, you know, all these different writers and their voices, sometimes interviews with people, and show, you know, what is an individual experience? Because I think that is how people change, is learning about individual experience.
Yeah, I agree with that. So you wrote an article in the New York Times called The Emotional Power of Verbs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you thinking about, I think you were thinking about your students,
yeah,
and helping them, you know, make their writing jump off the page. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you mean by that? And I liked your use of the stickiness of our characters.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote that because as a writer, I had a lot of trouble learning plot. I really like describing people and things, but then I'd get stuck and I couldn't get them anywhere. And partly it was because I didn't really trust action or verbs. I felt like they made things suddenly into a car chase or something. And it was really trusting the poetic power of verbs and the poetic and the architecture of a story and how action is emotional. It took me a long time to figure that out, but then I thought, oh, it is actually about verbs.
Well, being that you have, you've talked about the creative process a little, but you also mentioned chaos. So do you have a creative process? Is there a structure to your writing at all?
Well, I think, when I was, before I published my first novel, I was, fitting in writing with work and, adjunct teaching and fact checking, whatever I could do to and then have writing time. And then when we had kids, of course that made that made my writing schedule, anything, kind of fly out. So what I learned to do, and my husband is also a writer, we would just find time to write, whenever we had a moment. And actually our kids had a kind of an early bedtime for actually too long. They would be mad, if they saw other kids' bedtimes probably. But, they would go to sleep, sort of early, and then we would write at night. So, with kids, I think it really was just like I had to write whenever I could.
I just wanted to mention that Karen Ebender is here for the Virginia Festival of the Book. Well, I've already mentioned that a few times, but specifically, you're here for a panel today at noon at the New Dominion Bookshop, a great bookstore, for a panel called Short Stories Long on Meaning. Mm. Yes. I don't know if you knew the name of that, but very clever. And the website, your website is KarenEbender.com. So what is your latest work? Do you have something new that's coming out?
I am working on new stories. The New Order is my newest book. I have a new story, very short story in the Yale Review Online called The Shame Exchange, which was based on this idea that I had. What if everyone in the government that had no shame exchange it with people that had too much, which is basically everyone that I know? That was a fun thing to explore. And then I'm just working on new things right now, yeah.
And I was actually wondering, when you were talking about Scoundrel Time, Karen, if being an editor, does that help you like make editorial changes on your own work? Does that brain work when it's your work in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if editing has helped me as much of my work as teaching has. Having to explain, what is plot, or how do you create urgency in a story, or how to dig in and bring out, strong parts of the story. Having to articulate that to students has really helped my own writing, because I've had to figure out how to tell them, and then I apply it to my own work.
What do you think the relationship is between these very tough, heavy subjects that you address and humor?
That's a great question. So a lot of my stories that deal with very dark subjects are funny or irreverent, and some of my favorite writers are irreverent. I mean, Philip Roth is one of my idols, and he's, hilarious. And, I love Paul Beatty's work. I love Grace Paley. So I look at those writers and I just love their bravery and how I think humor is a way of shouting back. It's a way of claiming power. I think good humor is also born of deep emotion. Word on Highest Synagogue actually is kind of a funny story, but it's born of fear. So I think the fear motivates the attempts to deal with the absurd, which is trying to control the uncontrollable. So I think looking at life through this absurd lens is one way I've tried to cope. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I did want to also mention that on April 14th, Karen will be in L.A. at the L.A. Festival of the Book. And your website again is KarenEbender.com.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a joy to have you.
Oh,
yeah, it was great.
Oh, thanks.
Good luck this at noon.
Nancy and I are a big fan of humor and and dark topics. Nancy, do you have a news of note for us?
It's not very funny, but yeah, oh. I do.
You need Karen to put a twist on it. Will you put a twist on whatever Nancy's about to say?
Yeah, well, no pressure there, but maybe, no doubt this could wind up in a short story of yours, or who knows, a novel. Let me not put limits on you. A federal court, so that's never good.
It's never good.
Has rejected the administration's claim that it has no responsibility for potentially thousands more children and parents that were ripped apart under, you know, the administration's family separation policy. They'd already been ordered by a federal judge in the summer of 2018 to reunite thousands of migrant families it had cruelly separated. But after a new report found that thousands more than previously known had also experienced this cruelty, the judge massively expanded his ruling to account for every single stolen child. He's determined, so I guess that is the good news. They must return all families separated since July 1st of 2017. He's called it family reunification has become so difficult because his administration is so thoughtless and so careless in its accounting. When they separated, you know, kids, obviously they didn't bother to have a plan. But he is, it's his quest to ensure that all these kids and parents are reunited to their together. So despite Secretary Nielsen claiming that who knew that this could be so traumatizing, you know, I had no idea, as she claimed. Anyway,
well,
that's it.
You are doing what Karen Ebender says. It is our job and the writer's job to keep our eyes open. So even though it's hard to hear, thank you for bringing these things up each show.
And thank that judge, hopefully.
Yes.
Anyway.
Hopefully. Thank you.
That's the news.
Yeah, that's the news of the day. So let us go to our next guest. She is a writer, speaker, and oral historian. Her name is Susan Devan Harness. Her new book is Bitterroot, a memoir of transracial adoption. It's a sweeping examination of her life that explores the uneasy intersection of race, history, and the brutal government American Indian policies that affect the lives of her and her family. She's born in Montana to a family living on the Flathead Indian Reservation. She became a transracial adoptee at the age of 2 when she was removed from her home by a social worker because of supposed neglect. So welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. So I know from 1958 through 67 and maybe even into the 70s, the Indian Adoption Project was a federal program, and it removed more than a quarter of all Navajo children from their homes and placed them up for adoption with white Christian non-Indian families. So, and I know your book is all about your life. So can you, I don't know where a good place to start would be, but could you tell us where you'd like to start about your life and how this book came to be?
Well, first, let me do a little bit of clarification of what the Indian Adoption Project is.
Sure.
So it was an informal child placement policy, assimilation policy, that was a handshake agreement between the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Child Welfare League of America. And the Child Welfare League of America has since apologized for their role in it. But it was a social experiment. And it was a social experiment to figure out how well American Indian kids would fare in white families. And this was to address the issues of dysfunction on American Indian reservations. So the high alcoholism and the low literacy rate and high birth mortality and a lot of health problems. And, of course, all without the question of where those originated. It was seen as, at the time, kind of a genetic flaw, I think, instead of colonization. And so it was 395 kids that they followed in these families. 97, I think, were chosen to be part of the actual study itself. And they interviewed parents together, and they interviewed parents apart, and they interviewed parents together, and then they interviewed the mom, and just to see how well it was going to do. Within 3 years of this 9-year project, it was deemed so successful because the kids seemed to thrive and everybody seemed to do well and parents seemed to really bond with their kids that the floodgates opened. And suddenly state social services workers were placing children and Lutheran Family Services and Catholic Charities and the Methodists and the Pentecostals and the Mormons and the Jews all got involved in placing American Indian children, so that by 1974, it was thought that over 30% of American kids nationwide, American Indian kids nationwide, had been placed with non-Native families, which has a huge impact on American Indian communities, and has they just knew where to put a wedge in that dividing line of who's Indian and who's not.
And the aim of it, which was what your first book was about, which is why, you know, we wanted to start there, was the aim of this project assimilation and virtually, would you say, extinction of the tribes as they know themselves to be?
I believe it was an assimilation policy, and I believe it came on the heels of a lot of the assimilation policies the government had put into place. The assimilation policies, as many policies are formulated and packaged in a way to make them palatable. So this was, let's save the poor, forgotten Indian child. Let's make sure that we place them in a situation where they have access to all the wonderful things in life and to that American dream. And this way, we're going to save American Indian populations. Well, if you really look at the American Indian policies, it's been to fragment, and it's been to move, and it's been to remove, and it's been to pull away from, and it's been to take children away. And I think the Indian Adoption Project was tragically the most successful assimilation policy to date, because these were closed adoptions, and we were never supposed to find our way home.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Susan Devan Harness. She is a member of the, Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. We're going to talk with her much, much more after this break. Stick with us. Good morning. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Susan Devan Harness. Her new book is Bitterroot, a memoir of transracial adoption. So thanks for clarifying all of that for us. Please feel free to keep bringing that in just so that we can understand, because so many of us know nothing about any of this. I have to say I didn't know anything about this, so not surprised, but thank you so much for clarifying. So tell us about the book, and I know you were here for two panels. How were those panels?
The first one was Family Myth and Love in Transracial Adoption, and I was presenting with Nicole Chung, who had written All You Can Ever Know. And it was really, I think, the first book festival that either one of us had been to that had a transracial adoption panel on it, which is really good, because there were a lot of people in the audience that either had transracially adopted or they had somebody in their family who had. So it's a lot more common than I think we've been led to believe. And there are a lot of questions, because to talk about it is kind of a taboo subject.
And transracial, can you tell us what that means?
So transracial means that you've got a child of one race. And to keep in mind, race is a culturally constructed term. It has nothing to do with genetics, but it is a cultural construction, and it's based on physical difference. So you have a child from one race that is placed with a family of a different race, and the vast majority of these adoptions are they're one way. They're children of color being placed with white families, which presents its own challenges to identity and power and hierarchy, and it pulls a lot of those issues into that dynamic.
And why, Susan, did you make this your second book, Bitterroot? Why did you write your own story?
I did my research 10 years ago in cultural anthropology. that specifically looked at American Indian transracial adoption, because I knew that there were a lot of us, but getting people to talk about that experience was extremely difficult. Just growing up, I would try to bring up the conversation with people that I'd found out were American Indian and were adopted, and they were very, very reticent to talk about it. And as I started pulling this information together, there was almost no information in the literature, in the academic literature, about it. And so as I started pulling the information together, I had a chance to talk specifically with several adoptees that had agreed to do the oral histories with me. And it was so validating to me to hear these stories, and it was validating to them to tell these stories. This kind of gives you an idea of how important it was. As I was talking with one adoptee, and I was telling her what my interest was and what I'd hoped to accomplish, and I said, I really am interested in talking with you because I'm an American Indian transracial adoptee. And she said, then you know what it's like. And I thought with that statement, that was a really powerful statement. And of course, I did know what it was like, but I knew what my experience was like, and I wanted to find out other people's experience. So then when I had this information, how do I tell that story? How do I put a face to that research? Because sometimes research can be overlooked because it's considered dull, or, you know, the way scientific research sometimes is. And I'd been given permission by several of the adoptees to use their stories. But, you know, there was so much pain in these stories that I really felt that they were not my stories to tell, that if they wanted to tell them, they belonged to them. And then I thought, well, I could write a fiction piece. And then I thought, no, I don't want to write a fiction piece because I don't want anybody to say, oh, well, she really dramatized this event because nothing could happen like that. That's not what adoption's about. And so I didn't want people downgrading what it looks like. So then it becomes like, well, if I want to tell the story and I don't want to use other people's experiences and I want to make it real, then I need to tell my story. And it took me a couple of years to really think about how badly I wanted to do that, because you kind of cut yourself open and fillet yourself for everybody to see. But I felt in the long run, it was really important, and it has opened up the door for adoptees to come forward and add their voices to this really, really important social discussion.
Well, I'm so curious about what your experience was like. Can you tell us a little bit about your story and how you came to find out, you know, what had happened to you?
Well, my story, it was a closed adoption, which meant I really didn't know anything. I always knew that I was adopted. My parents never hid that. I knew that I was American Indian. I found out when I was a little older, when I was 5 or 6, that I belonged to the Salish tribe that was about 50 miles north of us. But when I would question my dad on it, he would deflect, at first just saying, you know, your parents died in a car accident. The second time it was with a lot of more anger of, you know, we are your real parents. You know, we clothe you, we feed you, we provide you housing. We are your real parents. And that shuts a conversation down quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I figured my parents had died in a car accident, and I had contacted years later social services in order to obtain some money from the treaty money that had been in an account. And I just happened to ask the woman, do you have any information on my parents? And she said, well, why don't you come on up and in a couple of weeks, and I'll see what I have. And at that at that moment, she left the office. When I'd gone up there 2 weeks later, she took me into her office. She said she had to go to a meeting. She left me in her office. And as I'm sitting in her office and trying not to look at the myriad of paperwork on her desk, because that's not my business, I happened to see a file with my name on it and a pad of paper and a pencil nearby. And so she didn't tell me what happened, because that's privileged information, which I got to say, my adoptive mom had told me for years, nobody should know anything more about you than you. And so I was able to look at the file and realize that my birth dad had died about the time that I was five, but my birth mom was still alive and living on the reservation. And then it becomes, how do I contact her? And there were a lot of challenges and barriers to that situation. And eventually, I was able to get in touch with her through kind of a fluke. There had been a tribal newspaper, and a person had written this letter to the editor, and it started out great. It started out, if you don't like what tribal council's doing, consider running for yourself. But then all of a sudden it went into, there are too many white Indians on this reservation, and the only time they admit that they're being Indian is when the per capita checks come out. Per capita checks are our payments for the land leases that we do, the grazing leases, the water leases, the timber leases. So those are not government monies. Those are the leases that our land provides, the resources that we provide. So, you know, you're not Indian. You never had to grow up in the 70s when you had to be Indian and proud, and you come up here and you try to tell us how to live, and you don't know what it's like to be Indian. And I mean, he had pushed every social button that I had imagined being pushed. And so I wrote a letter back and just said, I really disagree with you. You know, we were placed for adoption. I didn't see your hand being raised to take us in. And, you know, it's not my fault. And if you want to be Indian and proud of being Indian, try living in Great Falls, Montana, where everybody you know is white. And you don't know how to run home and take that racist comment and talk with somebody about what that feels like. And I signed my name. And I signed my birth name, which I had from the file. And a week later, I was called by two of my sisters who said, we've been looking for you since you were 18.
Wow.
Who else in your family, who else in your family have you found? Not that you found them all at once. Actually, that would be part of my question, too. So who else in your family have you found?
Well, actually, I did find them all at once, because what the sisters had done is they had invited me to kind of a family reunion that was a yearly get-together. And so my brother was there, and aunts and uncles were there, and cousins, and my birth mom was there. The only people I didn't see were, you're right, three siblings, two of them were living off the reservation, and one of them had passed away. So that's where I met everybody, and it was a emotionally charged day.
Can't imagine, actually. I have read that it might not have been at that reunion, but you have heard from members of your birth family. They tell you that you were lucky, that you were raised elsewhere, and I just wondered if you feel lucky or if you agree with how they see it.
That's a great question, because you know, we live in a dichotomous society. Our society likes things to be clean cut. They like things to be right or wrong or good or bad. And transracial adoption, especially when it's domestic, and especially when it deals with intense colonization, and especially when it deals with identity, is messy. It's complicated. And there is nothing that is easy about it. So as I've gotten to know the reservation a lot better in the intervening 25 years, I understand where they're coming from. And I will say that I did receive a lot of benefits for my adoption, but I'm going to add it with the caveat, I paid a high price for those benefits.
I was going to ask you what the effects were for you, if you don't mind sharing some of what and how others have felt as a result of this.
A lot of the effects is I became a lightning rod of racism. And, you know, you're the only brown face in the school, and kids say things that their parents say. And so there's the name calling and there's the labels. My adoptive mom did a great job of trying to control that. I can remember when I was in third grade and this kid that I had like the worst crush on, out of the blue called me a squaw. And I didn't know exactly what that meant, but I knew the way he said it, it wasn't good. And so I went home and I told my mom, and my mom went into the teacher and said, this is going to stop. And she said, well, Susie's doing so good. I mean, we have some little Mexican kids that won't even go out on the playground anymore. And my mom said, I don't care. This is going to stop. You either make it stop or I'm going to the superintendent. And at that point, the superintendent was a member of the Blackfeet Indian Reservation tribe. And so that got squelched pretty quickly. But or what happens is you get people who kind of forget who you are because you talk just like them and you attend the same things that they go to, and you know, you just look different. And so therefore you must think the same way that I do. And so I was very well aware of how a lot of whites in Montana felt about American Indians. It took a lot of energy to grow up in that environment.
Is it, are you always wondering how you are Native and Native American? Is that, do you always have that in your head, or how does that exist in there?
That's another great question, because I think for so long I was listening to what other people said I was. You know, there is an ascription of identity from the larger culture. And when you're transracial, a lot of times you get it from both sides of those ethnicities. So I had whites telling me, oh my gosh, you know, you're Indian and you're this and you're that. But they also had the questions of, well, why don't you know your language, or why don't you know your family? And then when I tried to make contact with the American Indian culture, they had a lot of questions of, well, why don't you know your language? Why don't you know your family? And why don't you know anything about your culture? And you're not Indian, you're white. You talk white, you look white, you act white. And so for a long time, you know, I mean, I did the powwows and I did beadwork and I did shawls and I did all of those things. But I think for me, being that kind of Indian was like trying to be that kind of Lutheran, that you don't go in and do your religious training over a period of 3 days and poof, you're a Lutheran. It's far more complicated. And I think where I became aware of how I felt is when I went to a counselor, and I'd looked at her walls, and it was covered with all kinds of Indian artwork and things, and she had mentioned that she was Cherokee, and she was very proud of it. She was the 32nd Cherokee, and I thought, you don't know what it's like.
that theme again. Well, thank you so much for being here. It was really wonderful to talk with you. Susan Devan Harness, her book is Bitterroot, a memoir of transracial adoption. It was a finalist in the Colorado Book Awards. She's a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. And you are going to be, let's see, where are you going to be? In Berkeley.
There you go.
Yep. At the Bay Area Book Festival. May 4th and 5th.
I will.
Yes, I'm glad that you're getting the word out. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Hey, Nancy, I think we're out of time, so I'm going to just say that a little shout-out to our theme music, Springtide. It is out of Japan, and remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Thanks, Nance. Thanks to our guests, Karen E. Bender, Susan Devan Harness.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham Team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.